This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning and welcome to AM. I'm Kim Landers. Dozens of people have been rescued and hundreds more have fled their homes as Greater Sydney's flood crisis continues. While some of those evacuations are in the southwest, it's the Hawkesbury River in the northwest where there's still major flooding. Communities there are still in recovery mode from the disasters earlier this year. So businesses and charities are focusing their efforts on finding short-term housing for people who've been displaced, as Gavin Coote reports.
It's a desperate effort to pump water out of homes and move belongings to higher ground in this cul-de-sac at Windsor, northwest of Sydney. A swollen creek, which forms part of the Hawkesbury catchment, is now lapping at Jeremy Muller's garage.
We won't be staying here tonight. We're just trying to put a few things up high that we can't replace and stuff like that. We're one of the lucky ones. We do have insurance, which a lot of people don't. So, yeah, we're just putting up stuff that we can, and then we've already moved our caravan and everything, so we'll stay with friends tonight.
The evacuation process isn't simple, though. Many roads and bridges are now cut off from the floodwaters. For people like Jeremy Muller, relying on friends and family for a safe roof over their heads is becoming all too familiar.
We don't want to overstay our welcome. That's what makes it hard, is this is the third time in 3 years that we've gone and stayed with them, and we don't want to overstay our welcome.
Defence personnel have been working their way through each street in this neighbourhood, checking on people's welfare. And business owners are doing their bit to help as well.
Thank you for calling Rachel's office.
This real estate office in Windsor is lined with sandbags as floodwaters reach the bottom of the building. But the owner, Rachel Goldsworthy, is busily trying to sort out housing for affected clients.
As part of our process, we send out messages to our tenants, to our landlords, to anybody in the community that we're familiar with. So all along the riverbed that we've seen, it's just a sorry sight to see when you have to walk back in there and see everybody's personal belongings under, you know, feet of water.
Were some of them still displaced from the last flood? Did some people, you know, hold off moving back in?
Absolutely. We had emergency housing available for people, and also there's emergency housing available in this flood. But certainly what we're finding is if we have some vacant properties and we utilise those vacant properties to rehouse people during the floods. We're only just recovering from the last flood that came through, and insurances are only just paying out on that. And unfortunately, we've got rain predicted for the next, I guess, week. And then after that week is cleared up, and they're hoping that things will be fast recovery.
The task of getting food to isolated residents is also getting more difficult. The charity Hawkesbury Helping Hands is distributing pallets of donated food with some help from rescue crews on boats. Linda Strickland is the charity's CEO.
The river rose quicker than I've ever seen it. Yesterday we had organised the 30 pallets of food to go to the west side of the river where we set up a distribution centre so that the SES can come down and get food. People over there impacted. We have people with canoes can come in and everyone checks on the neighbours. The longer the bridges are closed, people run out of supplies. That's when it becomes more needy, or when people haven't stocked up. So we probably will be slammed. We're going to be busy over there regardless, but the SES and emergency services will be using us more in a few more days.
Linda Strickland from Hawkesbury Helping Hands, ending Gavin Coote's report. Russia's President Vladimir Putin has congratulated his troops after claiming victory in the eastern Ukrainian region of Luhansk. It's a significant win for the invading Russian forces, but Ukraine says its retreat is strategic and Moscow should expect a counterattack. Here's Europe correspondent Nick Doll.
For weeks, residents living in Lysychansk have had to deal with the frightening noise of incoming shells. After Russia took over the strategic city of Severodonetsk, Ukrainian troops in Lysychansk have been trying to hold out to keep at least a foothold in the Luhansk region. But over the weekend, the pressure from Vladimir Putin's forces got too much. Overnight in Moscow, the president congratulated his troops at a briefing with the defence minister. I ask you to give a state award to all service personnel who have excelled during this military action, the president said. I know there's a lot of brave, professional and gutsy soldiers in the Russian army. All the troops involved in achieving victory in Luhansk should rest and increase their combat capabilities. The governor of Luhansk, Serhii Haidai, says Ukrainian troops could have stayed to fight, but it would have been high risk and low reward. There was a risk of encirclement around Lysychansk, he said. The units which were there could have continued to hold the territories for 1, 2, or 3 weeks longer, but the question was the price of this action. The guys would have lost their lives for nothing. It could have been a Mariupol, a mini Mariupol. That's why the decision was finally taken to withdraw the forces. Having taken all of Luhansk, Russia's expected to try to push even further into Donetsk, the other region that makes up the wider Donbass. Serhiy Haidai says Ukrainian forces have been strengthening their defences there and Russia will find it much harder to make gains. When Ukraine's replenished its supplies, he says there'll be a counterattack. Samuel Cranny-Evans is an analyst from the United Services Institute. He says Ukraine had to devote a lot of military resources to defending Luhansk because the front line jutted out into Russian-held territory. He says Ukraine can now be more focused.
They were previously very much sort of surrounded by Russian forces, or at least enclosed on three sides, which was creating a lot of challenges, as it historically has. So now the front line has sort of been consolidated to some extent. But really, the big onus for the Ukrainians now is to maintain that front line and not suffer any further withdrawals so that they can begin to slow the Russian advance and then hopefully move on to the offensive themselves.
He says while Russia's progress might be slow, military leaders in Moscow believe they could eventually win a war of attrition. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says his troops have the staying power, but they'll need a constant supply of weapons from the West.
Nick Dole reporting. Well, millions of people have fled Ukraine since the Russian invasion, and while most have gone to countries in Europe, such as Poland, others have arrived in Australia. One of those families has ended up in the small West Australian town of Nanup. Here's National Regional Reporter Eliza Borello.
Until Russia invaded Ukraine, 42-year-old Regina Rozumovska, her husband and her two children were living a comfortable life near the Ukrainian capital, Kyiv.
My husband is the owner of the biggest nurseries in Ukraine. Well, he was, because all his nurseries are completely destroyed because they are all near Donetsk. We were, let's say, middle class, even up middle class before the war started. Now I cannot classify who we are because all our properties are either in Ukraine or in Russia, and it's nothing. It's almost nothing now.
The family spent 7 days in a bomb shelter before fleeing to Nanup, a small rural town 3 hours south of Perth.
Our friends message us once the war started. They live near Nanup on a farm, and they told us, so get on a plane and come to Australia. I never thought that the local community could be so friendly and so supporting. Because they have donated things, money. So on the first day of our arrival, we got clothes because we had just one suitcase with kids' clothing and something for us.
The family is among more than 3,200 Ukrainians who've arrived in Australia since the war started. The president of the Ukrainian Association of Western Australia, Mykolo Mozan, says while the refugees are grateful for safe harbour, they're used to living in multi-storey apartments or villages, and many feel isolated in places like Perth.
These are people like yourself, and they're living through what you may have lived 10 years ago, or Vietnam's case 40 years ago, or in the Europeans' case, whether you come from Greece or Italy or war-torn France back in 48, we've got the same situation happening in 2022 now.
Regina Rozumovska is about to look for remote work in marketing or analytics and says her husband will try to find a job in a nursery. But she says what Ukrainians in Australia really need now is company.
Communicating, trying to invite these people for a chat, just to have a cup of coffee. Because for us, what we lack at the moment, we lack friends. And for us, the most valuable thing now, if we have friends here.
Ukrainian refugee Regina Rozumovska, ending Eliza Borello's report. A perfect storm of flu, COVID and a shortage of doctors is making it harder than ever to see a GP. New data from Australia's largest health booking agency backs that up. It shows the average waiting time to get an appointment has blown out and in some states almost doubled since 2019. Medical reporter Sophie Scott has the story.
Tracy Ellum's 14-year-old son Harrison has asthma and relies on seeing his GP in the New South Wales Hunter Valley to manage his symptoms. But with so much demand on doctors, that's been difficult.
It's definitely been challenging getting into the GP of late. We're finding, you know, that we could be waiting up to a week or two before the doctor can see us, which obviously can be concerning when you've got a chronic medical condition such as asthma.
Well, it means I sometimes have to take days off school.
Yeah, it is definitely worrying. Asthma is one of these things that is deadly and, you know, that is the scary fact.
It's a situation repeated across the country. Former AMA President Dr. Mukesh Haikerwal runs a busy GP practice in Altona, southwest of Melbourne. He says the delays are due to severe GP shortages, workforce burnout, and soaring levels of illness in the community.
The demand has suddenly come out of the woodwork as well because people have been locked down, not been seeking treatment, and then they come in and when they get treatment, they book a conversation for 15 minutes. There's usually three, four or five problems at a time that they wanted to tackle.
New data from the Health Engine booking site shows in the last 3 years, the average wait time to see a GP in New South Wales has blown out to more than 4 days. In Victoria, it's now more than 3 days, and in WA, wait times have gone from 2 days to four. Dr. Bruce Willett is the Vice President of the Royal Australian College of GPs.
We are seeing a perfect storm of a whole range of issues coming together at the same time. We're seeing the influenza epidemic, we're seeing the COVID pandemic, we're seeing GPs trying to make up for the routine care that didn't occur during lockdowns, and we're seeing the chronic underfunding of Medicare, meaning that young medical graduates are not choosing general practice as a career. We're in fact in danger of running out of GPs because of that.
Doctors groups have been calling for a substantial increase to the Medicare rebate for GPs, but so far there's no indication that's going to happen. The Medicare benefits schedule rebate only increased by 1.6% from July 1st this year for most medical services, including GP care. The federal government says it's setting up 50 urgent care clinics, which will be bulk billed, making it easier to see a doctor. It's also set up a task force to identify the best ways to improve access to healthcare for patients with chronic illness and will distribute $220 million in grants to GP practices so they can see more patients.
Sophie Scott reporting. There's another wave of COVID infections hitting many states. Queensland authorities are predicting hospital admissions will jump by 10% in just 24 hours. And while governments are shying away from reintroducing mask mandates, some experts are questioning whether a fourth vaccine dose needs to be given to more people. Annie Guest reports.
2.5 years since Australia's first COVID case, epidemiologist Professor Nancy Baxter from the University of Melbourne warns there's no end in sight.
The pandemic is on the move. So the number of cases are growing, hospitalizations are growing. The reproductive number, which is how rapidly the outbreak is doubling, all of these things are increasing throughout Australia.
About 3,500 Australians are in hospital with COVID. That's already higher than the April peak attributed to the Omicron variant BA2. Professor Baxter expects Australia's grim milestone of 10,000 COVID deaths will be quickly surpassed.
And we are on track to have about 1,000 people dying in Australia of COVID every 3 weeks. This is going to be one of the major killers of Australians this year.
Today in Queensland, health authorities predict the number of people admitted to hospital with COVID will jump by more than 10% in 24 hours. But the state government yesterday ruled out a mask mandate. Professor Baxter says leaders aren't doing enough.
We've seen a number of politicians attend press conferences when they're clearly visibly ill, which is not sending a good sign out to the community in terms of what we should be doing. So that's number one. But number two, all the chief health officers are recommending masks in indoor spaces, yet we never see politicians in one.
Meanwhile, Australia's Technical Advisory Group on Immunisations, ATAGI, is considering whether a fourth COVID vaccine should be offered to more people, in addition to vulnerable populations and those aged over 65. It's something immunology professor Cassandra Berry from Murdoch University is in favour of.
I think a fourth shot, the fourth dose, should be made optional and rolled out perhaps in the first instance for those over 50. and then maybe even roll down to the age group of 20 to 29 because we know they have the highest case numbers.
She says boosting immunity to COVID is particularly important as people face the high prevalence of influenza.
Especially as people are travelling now and the vaccine mandates have been lifted for international arrivals, we're becoming more vulnerable as our protective antibody levels are waning.
Research data indicates a fourth vaccination produces a spike in COVID immunity. However, the rate of triple vaccinated Australians has stalled at about 70%, and less than half of children aged 5 to 11 have received two COVID vaccinations.
Annie Guest reporting. Supporters of two Australians detained in China say diplomats are again able to visit them. Journalist Cheng Lei has spent almost 2 years behind bars, while political writer Yang Hanjun has been locked up for more than three. Both have been tried in secret, and family and friends are pinning their hopes on a diplomatic breakthrough. East Asia correspondent Bill Birtles reports.
Businessman Nick Coyle has spent 2 years hoping diplomacy can help free his partner, Cheng Lei. The outgoing head of the Australian Chamber of Commerce in Beijing was motivated to recently break his silence after Ms. Cheng's monthly consular visits with Australian diplomats were cancelled. The visits have never been in person, only online, yet Chinese authorities still suspended them during a relatively mild COVID flare-up in the Chinese capital in recent months. He says the video meeting with diplomats was last week restored.
Those monthly consular visits are effectively the only window that she's got to connect with somebody from outside the detention centre. So, and they've been extremely important to her maintaining, you know, her emotional and mental health for the past 22 months and counting.
Ms. Cheng, a business news anchor for the Chinese government's English TV network, was tried in a closed court in late March on allegations of supplying state secrets to foreigners. At no point has China's government released any details about what she's accused of doing, prompting speculation the case is linked to the broader state of Australia's diplomatic relationship with China. Nick Coyle.
Well, the short answer is we just don't know. We don't know what the case is about. It's never been disclosed what the case about is, so we just don't know. The wider point I'd make is that there's been positive signs from China wanting to re-engage with Australia and obviously the new government wanting to engage positively with China. So these sorts of issues are some that can be discussed, that can be resolved, you would hope, relatively quickly and compassionately.
A verdict and sentence in Cheng Lei's case is now due this month, although authorities can continually delay it in China's secretive judicial system. That's what's happened to Yang Hanjun, a political writer who once upon a time worked for a branch of China's state security. He was tried in secret on espionage charges more than a year ago, and a verdict is now due this month. Analyst Yun Jiang, an AIIA China Matters fellow, says the political nature of the charges in both cases suggests China is likely using them for leverage.
We do not know what China wants in exchange for the return of these two Australians. It is possible that they have sent messages to the Australian government privately. I'm not sure. And from my perspective, I think the return of these two Australians should be a high priority for the new Australian government.
The Foreign Minister, Penny Wong, publicly said her thoughts are with Cheng Lei last month during her birthday, a signal that the case is front of mind. And with speculation mounting that Senator Wong may meet her Chinese counterpart Wang Yi at a forum in Bali later this week, the plight of the two Australians might be on the agenda too. This is Bill Birtles in Taipei reporting for AM.
And that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Kim Landers.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. More than 10,000 Australians have now died from COVID-19. And there are still around 50 people dying every day. Per capita, that's among the worst in the world. Today we speak to a woman still struggling to comprehend the loss of a loved one from COVID, and to an epidemiologist about how Australia went from world leader in controlling the disease to bottom of the pack. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.